This week on the show, the internet is the new town square, a paywall is just a paywall, and all about freemium. Meanwhile, don't be the promotion police. All this on This Week in Media, episode 152. Another episode of This Week in Media. If you're watching live, yes, you get to see my adorable puppy dog, Violet. She's here in camera with me. Okay, say bye to Violet. I'm Daisy Whitney, and this is This Week in Media. It is Monday, September, I think it's the 28th. That sounds like a good day. And I have a lovely guest lineup with me today. Actually, they're kind of regulars. Hello, Tim. Tim is here as usual. How are you, Tim?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Daisy. How are you doing?
I am excellent. Tim Street is the executive producer of French Made TV, and he is a guru of all things online video. And do I understand correctly that you have a new ebook out today?
I do. I have a new free ebook. You can download it at onetimstreet.com. And it's 10 things you should do before you upload your online video.
Can you give us two of those tips just as a little teaser, maybe?
Well, I think the big one is you should know what your goals are before you upload and kind of have an idea. And then another one, make friends with people who buy digital ink by the barrel. That might be one there.
Well, people who buy digital ink by the barrel would be what? Is that YouTube?
It might be you. You write a lot and talk a lot about online video. So you want to know those people who write about online videos and talk about online videos.
Okay, good. All right, and I'm sorry. I apologize. I was interrupting Tim. We're doing this all remotely, so I'm not in the studio as I usually am. I'm doing this from my house, and Tim's at his house, and also Kevin Naltz, our other guest, is as well. So, yes, Kevin Naltz, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me back. I must have done something okay.
Well, okay. Yeah, you did something okay. Yeah, you were amusing. We like you. We're glad to have you back. You know, Kevin, how are you identifying yourself these days? I think most people listening to This Week in Media know you already from your viral video work and also from your consulting work. But you wear a lot of different hats. Are you primarily positioning yourself as an online video social media branding consultant these days?
Yeah, no, that's well put. I was going to say viral video genius or soon to be author of a yet to be written book for Wiley, but I like the way you just described it better. Although I did have a big week. I wrote the stupidest article ever about social media, and it's gotten some good uptake. I encourage you to read it.
Well, give us a little teaser. What's it about? When you said it's stupid,
it's sort of a satire of all these ridiculously annoying instant subject matter experts that do a couple Google searches, proclaim themselves Twitter and Facebook experts. And so it's self-deprecating intentionally.
Oh, good. All right. Well, we'll have to link that up. Send me a link to it. I'll make sure to Twitter it. And of course, okay. I'm Daisy Whitney. I'm the host of This Week in Media. I also am the host of the New Media Minute, which I do every week, and write for BTV. And you can find me online in a lot of places, daisywhitney.com. So just in case people are new and wondering who the heck this gal is who's hosting the show, that's who I am. We usually have Alex Lindsay with us. He is in Brazil, so we decided to give him the week off. So it's just kind of going to be the kids running the show. Dad's out of the office, as I like to say. So interesting story that I saw on CNET last week that MySpace is working on a new video service. And of course, this is interesting, of course, because MySpace's parentage involves News Corp, which is one of the co-owners or investors in Hulu. But basically, Rupert Murdoch said in July that he wanted to reshape MySpace into an entertainment hub. And CNET says that sources now say the site is going to launch a new video service sometime in the next several months with the help of its sister site, Hulu. But of course, it would presumably also be competitive to Hulu, because that's a space where Hulu has really come to be the leader in that kind of premium content viewing space. I guess what's still unknown at this point, according to the CNET story, is whether it will offer downloads or be a subscription service. I guess if that's the case, it would be complementary because it would be a pay model. Tim, what was your take on this story? What have you heard about it? And if this happens, kind of what do you think needs to be done for it to be differentiated enough from a business perspective and for consumers to understand it and use it?
Well, there's definitely a lot of different ways that it can go, and you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens. But with Hulu, a lot of the content that is there for a short period of time, and then it goes away. And consumers often complain about that. But that has to do with the different pay windows and the different deals that are done with all the different partners of Hulu. I think with this new MySpace deal, because it's a paid opportunity, it gives you a whole new way to access the content you want when you want it. You're not going to have to suffer through ads, hopefully. It would be terrible if you had to pay and watch ads, but I guess you pay for cable television and watch ads anyway. So what else is new?
Fair enough. So, Kevin, what's your take on this?
I mean, you guys are being too kind. I mean, I hate to be cynical here, but this smells of desperation. I mean, here's Hulu that's got a pretty good sized following, and then we've got MySpace, which has been deteriorating gradually. I wish we could look and see what type of traffic is hitting this vids.myspace.com site separately to see if it's growing and maybe offsetting some of the MySpace decline. But right now, I don't see anything terribly interesting about it, other than right now MySpace is effectively embedding Hulu, and I'm not sure MySpace has a strategy for what it's going to offer that's not already being offered from YouTube and Netflix and iTunes.
Well, and of course, MySpace has been one of the early partners in Hulu. Let's remember when it first launched, and I think this has become obviously much less important because Hulu became a destination unto itself. But one of the prongs of the strategy was that the content would be distributed across the web on Fancast and Comcast.net and Yahoo and MSN and MySpace and so on. But of course, that's always been part of the strategy. But of course, MySpace has tried and been successful in some ways with its own original series and partnering with original series. But to your point, Kevin, I think you're right. I think that at this point, you know, we clearly have YouTube dominant in one category, Hulu dominant in another category. And it's hard for me to imagine kind of what MySpace is going to bring to the table, because then we also obviously have iTunes and Amazon and Netflix, as you bring up. But MySpace has to do something, right? MySpace kind of has to reinvent itself somehow, and I wouldn't count them out.
Maybe it goes back to music. I mean, I think that's when I think of MySpace, I think of its roots in early music. And, you know, right now it's probably hard for an up-and-coming musician to get any type of significant traction on YouTube because it's so cluttered. So maybe that's a play. Original programming, I have a hard time imagining, just because you're talking about, a site, MySpace, that's, a distant, depending on what you look at on tracking online video, it's somewhere between 5 and 10th in the category or lower.
Right. And of course, along these same lines and kind of what works and what doesn't work, some media executives took shots at Hulu last week before the strategy that it has, which essentially is giving away hit TV series and movies online for free. Of course, we know it's not really for free because there are ads along with them, but in the sense that it's not a pay-to-play type of content model. Story I'm referencing right now is in Contentinople, which I've kind of been reading this site blog a little bit more. I love the name of it. Interesting play on words and all. But anyway, at Advertising Week last week, top media industry executives, according to Steve Donahue's story, said that the best model for content owners to pursue is a hybrid approach that relies on both subscription and advertising fees. That's what Major League Baseball CEO Bob Bowman said. Some folks from Verizon weighing in. I don't know. I guess, guys, I wonder, is this the usual media CEO saying don't give stuff away for free, and then they wind up giving it away for free? I mean, is the hybrid approach going to be the ultimate thing that works in the marketplace? And how is that going to work for the consumers?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that you have any other option other than to give away free just to get some initial ground and then ultimately charge because it's nice to have a business model. I thought what was interesting about this piece is this sort of third category whereby a cable subscriber would have access to premium content, which gives us effectively three tiers: the free ad-supported model, the pay-for-subscription model, or effectively an add-on if you're subscribing via, your content, your cable provider.
But what does this say about, what do you think, Tim, about the commentary that we're hearing from media executives and folks in the TV business about Hulu's business model. There are a lot of folks who are very vocal about the idea that it's a bad business model. Is it actually a bad business model?
They're just jealous. They're all jealous. They're jealous, jealous, jealous.
I mean, is Hulu going to do okay? I mean, I don't think our viewers are necessarily that concerned. Oh, it's just Hulu's financial fortunes, but people like watching Hulu. So from that perspective, is it viable enough to stick around?
You know, it's really hard to say because the business models that worked last year aren't necessarily working this year. And with independent content creators, new business models are developing all the time. What seems to be happening in the studio space, though, is that they are getting some type of sponsorship money up front to do product placement inside a series, and then they will give that series broken up. They'll give it away for free online in small episodes, and then they'll do deals where they may make it available domestically, all cut together like in a 90-minute special, and then they'll sell it off internationally. Because they've geo-protected it when it first came out, and they'll make it available overseas in regular television, pay television, and on the internet for pay-to-play.
And when it comes to the whole idea of free and how you use free, Kevin, you actually had a great take last week on My New Media Minute. In My New Media Minute, I talked about a couple of business-to-business companies, Magnify.net, as well as Watch Mojo. Magnify is a platform company. Watch Mojo is kind of like a production house, produces infotainment lifestyle type of videos and has marketers and brands like Coke and McDonald's as its customers, uses its videos. And both of those entities transitioned from free to paid models, essentially to license fees. And I talked about the whole idea of training customers early to pay. And then you kind of went with that and did a post on it. And I thought it was interesting because you talked about when you start for free and then when you go in for the meaningful upsell. And I think this can be useful learning for our media producers in the audience and obviously for, you know, media executives and folks like that who listen and watch the show as well. I want you to kind of explain and give a rubric, if such a one exists, for, you know, when do you hook them with the free model? When do you switch them to pay? And sort of how do you do the marketing so that it feels okay to your customers to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think you could look two different places. I think the article I wrote looked at some of the sort of recent startups that have migrated from a free model to a paid one. Right now, it's very difficult to get anything adopted widely without offering it up for free in some modified format. And then over time, you can take your loyalists and start upcharging them. But I think you can also, if you're a traditional broadcaster, you can also look no further back than pre-cable when television was free. And it was profitable simply by being ad supported. So I think what happened is then cable came in, sort of got these, you know, regular fees from viewers that may or may not have been, you know, really justifying that fee. And then all of a sudden, Hulu, which is effectively television pre-cable, gets criticized. So, I mean, I think the smart thing to do is to offer up, like Hulu has, free content. I see a day where Hulu, maybe in conjunction with other third parties, then gives the user the ability to either enjoy it low bandwidth with some ads interrupted or pay a couple bucks and watch it just like you watch it on iTunes.
And of course, you also talked about how you recently upped YouSendIt to a monthly fee and how that's something you absolutely don't mind paying for. Yeah, isn't that the greatest service ever?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's services out there like that that you know, initially you get hooked on, and then as your needs become higher and higher, YouSendIt's a good example that's commonly known. But, you know, I mean, even Gmail is leaving money on the table. I would certainly be happy to pay for what Gmail's offered, especially if it doesn't break like it did the other week and started a Twitter storm. But TubeMogul, too.
Were, like, interesting upgrades to Gmail. I mean, I think there's certain functionality that it's lacking. And I use it, you know, I solely use Gmail and I solely access email on the web. But and as great as I think it is, I do think there are additional features and functionality that, yeah, for $5 or $10 a month, Absolutely. I'd be willing to pay for that. Just things that would make it a little bit more, you know, just kind of artful. And there might be tricks already that exist that I'm just not familiar with. But I agree with you. I think there are definitely things that could be done and people would be willing to pay for it. Because the fact is, I mean, I think about my YouSendIt account. I absolutely don't mind paying that bill every month because I recognize the value. It brings a real something to the table.
And how quickly would you switch over, right? So you have these tangential one-off services. It'd be if you could integrate it all in Gmail and pay a monthly hosting fee instead of having to pay for your, you know, WordPress premium and your hosting fee and your YouSendIt to have it all centralized through one player.
Well, that's another cool idea too. Then it simplifies the process. It simplifies the process even more. So yeah, I think there are opportunities there. And the tough thing that you pointed out and that's important to remember is that those opportunities purely to offer content on this type of basis are not so obvious. There's not a lot of content that you're going to be able to convince people to pay for. So just, you know, bear that in mind. I mean, we're talking about more B2B type of plays, right?
Well, you know, Daisy, in the iPhone application world, where you could sell some content, there's a little bit different thinking there, is that you should offer your content up for free. I'm sorry, you should offer your content up paid first and make sure that you have tracking analytics in it so that you can find out how the users are using that content. Are they using it frequently, like many times a day, or do they only play with it a couple times during the first 10 days that they have it? Once you know that, you'll understand if you have an application that's really good for advertising or if you should just stay paid. You can always go free and more people will adopt it. And you can use your free version to market something that is paid. But once you give it away for free, it's hard to get people to pay for it. It's much easier to get people to pay for it and then give it away for free if it's not selling well or, if it makes sense from an advertising standpoint.
And it's interesting. It's kind of a difference of opinion we have between the two of you. But hey, that's why we have a round table. Kevin is more of the hook them with free and then upsell. And Tim says, don't give it away for free until you know if that's a good idea. So I say potato, you say potato. I'm just kidding.
But, you know, it's a theme that's going across, I think, all the stories you've identified today is the sort of notion of, you know, what's free and what's not. And, you know, I don't know if you guys I got caught up on Dr. Horrible a bit late after the Emmys. I found myself hooked on the show. And then just yesterday at BJ's, picked up the DVD for $10 because it had some 45 minutes of extra footage I could enjoy. So I think once you've got a following, there are opportunities to take an upsell a certain group of those people. If you can, you know, market something, if you can sell something up front and get it widely adopted and then migrate to an ad model, that's great. But typically, an ad model is dependent on a significant amount of usage. It's very difficult to pick up steam on a paid app or paid content.
And the key, I think one of the key takeaways is remember to rely on data, as Tim pointed out, where there's an opportunity for you to look at analytics to see what's working and what's not, avail yourself of that. Now, speaking of analytics, interesting kind of privacy debate going on about what a project Netflix is working on. Essentially, Netflix plans to release anonymized data as part of an effort to crowdsource improvements to its recommendation system. I'm looking at a Media Post article. Netflix says, I mean, this obviously concerns a lot of privacy advocates, but Netflix says it's confident that this initiative won't compromise customers' privacy. When we do it, it will be completely anonymous, Netflix says. The end game is essentially to make the recommendation system even better. And I guess, you know, the privacy concerns might be somewhat interesting. I think I'm more interested, let's start with Tim, on your take on how you see this working. I mean, have you seen other efforts like this with crowdsourcing being used to improve recommendations? I mean, is that kind of like how the Amazon recommendation system works? And how does something like this play out in terms of can this actually make it better?
Well, I think any time that people are sharing stuff with their friends, that word-of-mouth marketing is going to make something better. Whether or not Netflix is going to be able to pull this off, I don't know.
Why do you say you don't know? Is it a technical challenge, Tim?
I just, it's, you know, you look at all the different social networking sites since Friendster came around, and there have been different things that have been hot. You know, Facebook is definitely, you know, the thing right now, as well as Twitter. How long will they be that way? And Netflix is the thing as far as, you know, getting DVDs delivered to your house. But how long will that last? It seems like people get very fickle about what it is that they use online. And I guess I'm really referring to early adopters. So I it's hard for me to guess what the folks in the middle of the country are gonna do here, and that's really where my question. I don't know if it's gonna, you know, if they'll be able to do it or not.
And of course, this is a contest that Netflix is running, and it comes with a $500,000 prize. So really, really not too bad. And it's a follow up to an earlier competition that the company had run. So yeah, so we'll have to see how something like that pans out. Now, have any of you guys had the chance to check out HBO Imagine?
Nope.
I'm looking forward to seeing HBO Labs in its second iteration.
Okay, so HBO Imagine. One of our listeners tweeted about this last week and wanted us to take a look at it. I looked at it. It's I think the website, yeah, the website should be HBOImagine.com, and it's offers 41 pieces of content, including short and long form video, audio files, news stories, letters, and images that are connected to each other. There's also this installation called The Cube that shows four different perspectives on the same scene simultaneously. And it's just a recent initiative. And I don't know what I think about it. So I want to get listeners' feedback. You know, you can reply to me or email me. I checked it out last week and I watched one of the videos. There was this interesting video about an affair, and just kind of showed different sides to, I mean, it was a very bizarre viewing experience because you watched it in this cube and you saw from the vantage point of one of the characters and from the vantage point of the other. So you as the viewer can see that there's secretive stuff going on. So it was interesting and it was well done, but I don't know what to make of it. I don't know what this is supposed to become. I mean, Kevin, have you looked into this? Do you have a sense of what HBO's goal is with this?
Well, I mean, we saw it with HBO Labs, the first online video model that, and which was later, of course, spun off. Sort of the attempt to make production cheap, make it very web-centric, et cetera. And if this is doing what I think it's doing, it's kind of taking that to the next level and saying, okay, we're storytellers, HBO, but now we're going to tell stories in ways that we couldn't through traditional television. And so I think The Cube's a cool example of where the medium really is being optimized. I mean, you know, there is some value to being able to sort of shift between vantage points. And if they come up with new models like that, that sort of bring a dimension to the storytelling experience that we couldn't have otherwise offered, then I see this as being a nice adjunct to their shows.
I think you're right. That's the key. It brings a new dimension to the storytelling because that's the key. How do you integrate technology in such a way that it enhances the storytelling? And again, even though I said I wasn't quite sure what to make of it, I was definitely focused. I was watching it. I was trying to figure out what angle is the key angle here. So it sort of stimulates your brain in a different way. So again, that's something where let's put that out there to the listeners and the viewers, and we'll definitely have to see what they say. And I should let people know who are watching live right now. I am not in the chat room. So if anybody is throwing out a question right there, I'm really sorry. I'm not going to be able to get to it because with me doing this remotely, it's a little bit hard to kind of manage that. So I apologize if you're seeking current feedback right now. Again, you know, always feel free to email me, daisywhitney@gmail.com. Here's a story I've been meaning to get to on the publishing side of the business. Actually, we have a couple publishing stories because there's some interesting things going on with Hollywood Trades. But then on the book side, local San Francisco author Kemble Scott has published a book here in San Francisco in a limited hardcover edition, actually, and recently was in the fifth spot on the San Francisco Chronicle bestseller list. But now this book has kind of an interesting publishing trajectory. This is a story from Publishers Weekly that just kind of walks through it. And the author essentially started by uploading the ebook edition of his second novel on Scribd.com, or it could be Scribd.com. I haven't quite figured out the pronunciation, S-C-R-I-B D.com. And then three publishers of various sizes approached him about doing a print run. And it's a very localized print run. He's really kind of focused on the first printing is exclusively to Bay Area independent booksellers. And one of his reasons for wanting to do this is that the traditional publishing route, you have much longer lead time with books. And you're talking about sort of a year to 18 months. Of course, they can pump out Michael Jackson memoirs, or no, not a memoir, sorry, that's not the correct term. You know, Michael Jackson biographies and retrospectives, you know, within weeks. But in this case, most books operate on at least a year production schedule. But what is so interesting is he wanted the book to have a very current feel, and it contains timely cultural references. So he didn't want to wait for that. So he was able to do this kind of limited print run. I don't know, this is just kind of fascinating. I think it harkens back to sort of early models of movies, as Publishers Weekly points out, but also just that it goes back to a theme we have here on TWIM, which is the role of local in this kind of hyper-local notion. So we have this interesting pairing of publishing and local. And I, what do you guys think about it? Tim, let's start with you, and then we'll go to Kevin.
I think it's really cool. I mean, the more time we spend on the internet, the more that we find out it's like a town square. And the stuff that we do isn't that new. It's all been done before in the villages of Europe back in the, you know, the Dark Ages or whatever. But it's so exciting and fun to see people be able to get their stuff out there immediately and get some traction. And the other thing that comes to mind in terms of the localization of this is not only is there a local audience geographically, there can be a local audience globally. So if you're into scuba diving, you could do something about scuba diving that all the scuba divers locally would be interested in. But then globally, they're part of a local, they're a global local group of people that are into scuba. It's fun. It's cool.
You know what I miss? I miss the day where somebody would publish the first chapter of a book as a freebie. And then I remember picking up a magazine and reading the first chapter of an assassination attempt on the presidency. And boy, I went out and bought that book within days after that. And I think to the local part, you know, I don't know about you guys, but if a movie was filmed locally near Philly, M. Night Shyamalan does a lot of his films here, I've got to see it. I was down in New Orleans, my home, and the Final Destination 3D version was shot there. I've got to see it. You can't really accommodate this in video or film, but with books, couldn't you localize the story in a way that gives that geography a story that was based in that geography? It wouldn't take that much work to effectively customize a book to its specific region.
And that's kind of a cool idea. Could you take a story like this or another story? Let's say it does really well in San Francisco. I mean, it is on the San Francisco Chronicle bestseller list, and then almost as you're saying, Kevin, kind of template it in a way and move it across different regions. If maybe do a tailored print run in New York and tailor it with New York City cultural references or Miami or something like that. Something that's going to, probably New York is a little too big, but something that's going to capture the attention of the local community in a way that this has in San Francisco. So yeah, it could be kind of an interesting potential. Like you have all sorts of, you would have different versions, which is how, you know, TV is in a lot of cases. You can take certain types of TV formats that are localized, not just in different countries, but in different regions around the United States. So we'll have to see. These are a lot of interesting, as much as publishing is a challenged business right now, I think we are seeing some clever examples of authors and entities and whatnot that are playing around and really trying to break the mold. Speaking of the publishing business, last week it was reported that Variety is going behind the paid wall in 2010 and that The Hollywood Reporter may be scrapping its print edition later this year, actually probably in October. And, you know, Tim, I remember earlier this summer you were at a conference where you said that both Variety and Hollywood Reporter were flyer size right now. Gosh, I mean, what a change in the Hollywood landscape. Of course, as many of you know, I was with TV Week for a very long time, and it was one of the first publications that ceased print publication. Lots of changes. I mean, these magazines have been supported in a lot of ways by the four-year consideration ads for award shows. You know, please consider this person for an Emmy and so on and so forth. And that's really gone down. Tim, as our man on the ground in Hollywood, what do you think about all of this? Is this good, bad, or just the way it is?
Yeah, it's just progress, isn't it? I mean, it would be great if they could survive, because, gosh, we love to see all those magazines in the waiting rooms as we go walking around different meetings in Hollywood. But I think the Hollywood Reporter and Variety are going to go away. You know, I find myself occasionally going to their website when somebody tweets something interesting. But other than that, I mean, Twitter is really where I'm getting the majority of my stuff. I mean, you've got Hollywood agents, Hollywood producers. You've got all these people who are tweeting stuff, and you find it out. A lot of times, you'll find out news items before CNN just by paying attention to your Twitter stream.
Tim, can I throw a question at you from one of the comments of the article that Daisy spoke of?
Sure.
Okay, so this is a question. By the way, the most three frequent words you'll see commented around these articles are paywalls don't work, and somebody called them prey walls. I thought that was hysterical, which works for if you're Wall Street Journal, but you know, can one of these trade? So here's a question from one person's comment. Who would a studio rather give their exclusives to, a site locked up behind a paywall or a free site like Ain't It Cool will not only run the story but dance like a puppet to promote your film if you send them a box of toys or DVDs? So what do you do with your studio?
Well, I think it depends on who needs the information. I mean, you look at IMDb. That's a site that's used by Hollywood. There's a free version. There's a pro version, and I think that fits your model of the freemium. And also, it's like if you want the good info, you've got to pay for it to get to it.
And, you know, I think it's a good point that you bring up, Kevin, with Hollywood executives, because, you know, while we here on the show are a little bit, we're in the business, but we can be a little bit on the edge of it. I mean, I think about the folks who are at, you know, a Sony and a Lionsgate and MGM and so on and so forth, you know, who certainly may be on Twitter, but for them, there's such a cachet and also just the expectation that they are reading a Variety every day, that you go into work and all of the important news is in there. And again, we can say how, yes, it was certainly that way for newspapers 10 or even 5 or even a few years ago. And now, you know, more people beyond just early adopters have shifted away. I'm curious if those type of sort of day in and day out Hollywood staffers are also getting their news from Twitter, or if they would be willing to go to the online sites, to THR.com and Variety.com. I mean, what do you think about that, Twim? Tim, sorry.
Sure. There were, I've had meetings with TV show executives who don't check their own email. They have their assistant check their email, print it out. They write responses on it. They give it to their assistant. Their assistant sends the email. So it really depends on you know, that individual. But I think as we move forward, everything's just going to go electronic. You know, maybe you get a PDF version. I don't know. But the paper doesn't make sense.
It's the evolution, as you say. So I want to get to some listener questions, since I think we've got some good time to go into them right now. So this is a question from Jersey Droz. I hope I got the name correct. One of my Facebook friends had a question on apps and mobile content. He brought up this example of a niche band that has a free iPhone app, Immortal is the band, featuring streaming music, news, discography, tons of content, et cetera, and as we get closer to the mythical tablet, do mobile apps become the new home pages for content? Tim, you're kind of my app expert for now. What do you think? I mean, it's sort of an interesting question. I mean, if that is the case, how should content creators update their thinking in terms of presentation and organization of that app homepage?
Well, I've definitely drank the app Kool-Aid from Apple. And I see huge, huge things. I mean, they've already had 2 billion downloads of iPhone apps so far. I think we really need to pay attention to the homepage of the apps that we build, because I can imagine, like right now with my iPhone, I can control a computer across the room or in another part of the house by using my iPhone to control that. So I can access my iTunes, I can watch music, I can listen to music, and I can do all that with my iPhone through an app. And so I think we're going to have more of that experience. If you take that same experience and you now put it into a tablet, you can have some really interesting content to where you can pick and choose stuff, you can navigate stories, you can do all kinds of interactive storytelling. And I don't necessarily mean choose your own ending, but stuff that we haven't even thought of yet, formats that haven't been invented, just like the early days of TV. You know, people were taking radio shows, putting them on TV, and it was horrible. And that's what we're doing right now. We're taking TV shows, put them on the internet, and it's like, it's just not as good as TV. But what's the next step? When are we going to use all the different technology? When are we going to use all the interactivity to tell a story that's immersive? You know, the ARG people do it a little bit, but it's those stories come to an end. So it'll be interesting to see how we can evolve the technology so that the story doesn't have to end and it can be an ongoing series that's interactive.
Well, where do we even stand with this mythical tablet? I mean, it wasn't introduced in the early September Apple event. What's kind of the latest on, you know, when this is going to...
January is usually when they announce big products.
Okay.
So like the iPhone was announced in January, but this will be the first year that Apple doesn't go to Macworld. So who knows?
And now, Kevin, what do you advise your clients in the social media? I mean, because you have a lot of brands that you're talking to in when you're wearing your consulting hat. What do you advise them, not just about the iPhone in general, but just about this whole idea of sort of what is their homepage for content and how should it be treated in such a way, given that, you know, that we're viewing things on so many different type of devices? Does that intersect with the type of strategy work that you're doing?
Well, I mean, to a degree, there was a time back when we first created websites for brands and companies where everybody had this ambition that their company or corporate brand site would sort of become the homepage of every web viewer. And I think the same thing is true for, you know, the folks, the brands that are ambitious enough to try to create an application that becomes the destination of every user. I think what will be more interesting is when some of these app developed, you know, tools by which we can advertise via them. And I also like the apps as a utility for customers, you know, tools that can allow the company to extend its offering. I mean, you know, Tim spoke earlier about some apps that are kind of throwaway novelty items. My brother's the first guy at a party to, you know, pull out the latest novelty app. But others are sort of enduring, ongoing, and have a utility within them. So, you know, I'd like to see brands, if they've got a natural extension that they could bring onto an application, to do so. Tim, what are the ones that tend to gravitate the sort of regular user? Are they functional? Are they, you know, are people using application?
Social media apps seem to be the ones that are used most frequently. If you have something that's a Twitter app that's used like 10 times a day, that's a great app for advertising. If you have something like, you know, an iFart that's, you know, used a lot right at the beginning and then it doesn't get used ever again, not so good for advertising.
Now, speaking of interesting apps, one of our listeners, Christopher Moore, pointed out that there's a fairly new iPhone app called Hitchcock, and he says it lets the user create storyboards using pictures on their iPhone, even create simplistic shots and animate a finished storyboard. And he's actually using it to work on a movie. I don't know. It's kind of just, I think it's just sort of interesting to put that out there. Of course, I'm kind of amazed that you could write and storyboard a movie on an iPhone, but hey, aren't they the everything device these days? So I just kind of put that out there so listeners know about it and you know, maybe check it out if it seems interesting. I wanted to do a couple BlendTech My Business segments since I have you guys here and I have access to your fabulous brains when it comes to this topic. One of the things, actually, Tim, let's start with Trey Hefes.
Trey Hefes.
Okay, yeah. You take that one. You introduce it, because I don't know anything about it except you were Twittering about it and you said, I don't know if Daisy Winnie will be up for it. And I said, you know what? You were on the show too, so go ahead.
Okay, so Tres Hefes are three guys in Los Angeles. They're actually from Southgate, and they're part of the LA Podcasters group, and they've been podcasting for, I don't know, probably since 05, 06, somewhere around there. And they basically drink and record things as they drink. Now, sometimes they'll have guests on their shows. Sometimes they'll go visit a movie set. Sometimes they'll go visit a movie set that happens to be an adult film. These guys are just out there having fun, being silly. And a lot of the stuff that they bring to the table isn't stuff that is advertiser friendly. But it's definitely stuff that appeals to young males in the Latin community. And I think there's opportunity for them to, build their own brand and build their audience. If they had a product that appealed to that group of their listeners, I think they could definitely sell that. They couldn't do anything with alcohol because they consume alcohol, and the liquor companies have kind of self-imposed that you're not allowed to show any advertising where alcohol is being consumed.
It would be a good video series for them to do, kind of, or not necessarily a viral video, but given kind of some of the challenges of the brand, what would be, if you were advising them on creating a video series, what would it be?
I think it would be exploring the culture that borders on the illegal side of things, whether it be, illegal street racing and modifying your car, what you can do there, different things that appeal to that cultural group. I think they're underserved in the world of podcasting and video podcasting, and there's a lot of opportunity there. I've heard that there was a pay-per-view event about illegal street racing that did really well. There's a lot of stuff that goes on that, you know, may or may not be legal that has interesting stories, and people want to know about those stories. People want to understand that. It's like whispering, it gets attention. I think the same thing could be true of, one of the other ones, the WNBA.
We have a listener who's doing some work with the local WNBA team and just asked us any viral marketing ideas. So go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, I think there's a huge opportunity there to tell the stories of the young women who want to be in the WNBA, and really creating some videos that are showcasing these young, talented women who aren't old enough yet to be in the WNBA, but might be skilled enough to be in the WNBA. There would be a lot of spectacle, a lot of story that would be involved in those videos.
Kevin, do you want to add to any of these, or shall we start with the request from Shamie Reed to BlendTech the Obama healthcare plan?
Well, no, somebody's already BlendTech for healthcare. I mean, I think that two of my favorite sort of propaganda videos I've actually bookmarked on a YouTube channel called Think Different Health, youtube.com/thinkdifferenthealth. And one of them is called the Healthcare Reform Thought Bubble. It's the Vlog Brothers are talking about healthcare, and somebody put this beautiful visual ensemble to it. The other is called Why We Need Government-Run Healthcare. And both of these have really taken advantage of video, because they take the message and they bring it to visual life in such a sort of candy-like feel. And I think it's the same thing as what happened with Obama, that the liberals are winning the battle of the video propaganda. So I think online video plus healthcare reform have already started to take some good action. I'm not sure what I could offer to. I'm primarily, my background is primarily pharmaceuticals. So pharmaceuticals companies aren't exactly thrilled with healthcare reform, but.
And I, of course, will elect to stay out of any political discussion. So for whatever that's worth. Final listener thing, Jason Perrier, one of our regular listeners, said, not sure if you heard what's going on up in Canada with Facebook, but it started when a model from Toronto got booted from Facebook for self-promotion. She's since had a story actually in the Toronto Sun about that. And now apparently a Toronto DJ has been booted as well for apparently promoting his radio show. I don't know. Are you guys hearing anything, anything about sort of using Facebook for overtly marketing purposes and any guidelines that people need to keep in mind in terms of how they use it?
I, from my perspective, that's a dangerous area for a social media site to get into, because, I mean, who's not self-promoting? I mean, if self-promotion and YouTube didn't go together, my career would be over. I think you start to play promotion police And then you just have to ask the question, well, okay, what about the companies that have got brand Facebook? You know, every company now that I talk to wants to have a Facebook account. Is that going to be required that they, you know, pay a fixed fee of media to be able to do that? I'd be surprised if that starts to take any airlift.
Tim, you've got a couple events that you want to let our listeners know about.
Sure. Coming up Boston, October 7th and 8th, we have the Inbound Marketing Summit. Chris Brogan is inviting his cast of characters there for that. And then also Blog World Expo. Oh, I will be speaking at the summit, by the way. Blog World Expo in Vegas on October 15th through the 17th. Now, if you remember, Blog World bought the New Media Expo, so it's kind of like two shows in one now. So it's not just for bloggers. It is for new media folks as well. And it will be at the Las Vegas Convention Center. And I'll be speaking about iPhone applications there.
Tim, will you be showing up to Daisy Whitney's special iMedia Summit, iMedia Connections?
You know, I need some more information. Daisy, can you tell us about that?
Well, the I'm programming conferences now for iMedia, and Kevin is actually going to be teaching a master class at the one that I'm programming. Actually, I'm pretty much done programming it, which is a nice spot to be in. And that is going to be in Henderson, Nevada, just a sort of resort outside of the Las Vegas area, in late October, October 25th, 26th, and 27th. And we tend to have keynote speakers and lots of interesting kind of breakout sessions. And we do a lot of master classes. And Kevin is going to be doing one on successful strategies for online video brands. Is that fair to say? Kind of when to use YouTube, when to look at other sites, that sort of thing, kind of advice that you give to brands on their video strategy.
Yeah, I just thought of this spontaneously, but since it's right before Halloween, I think I'm going to offer up advanced copies of my Beyond Viral Video book for the most politically incorrect Halloween costume of some of the attendees.
Yeah, because I'm sure we're going to have a lot of attendees in their Halloween costumes. That's the type of crowd that we attract. Final event, I don't actually have the official date with me because I just thought of it, but for those of you in New York, I urge you to go to videonews.com, N-U-Z-E.com, and my friend Will Richman runs that site. It's really a terrific daily resource on the video business, and he's putting together an evening networking event. It's in mid-October. I think it's the 15th or 16th, maybe the 17th. Lots of great panelists, but again, especially good networking, and I think it's one of those events that's relatively inexpensive to attend, you know, $40, $50 type of thing. So if you're in the New York area, if you're interested, check that out. Kevin, where can people find you online?
Well, you could try Nolf's Consulting, but much more fun is willvideoforfood.com, which is a blog I write for creators and marketers, but is mostly commented by some of my bizarre online video fans.
Yes, you do have many wonderful online video fans. I enjoy the comments very much.
They love their Daisy. They love the Daisy Whitney hair.
Yeah, I know. I'm not quite sure how that started. I think I had a bad hair day one time. Kevin posted a video of me, and it just became this conversation unto itself. And that's why the web is a scary and wonderful place. Tim, where can people find you?
They can find me at onetimstreet.com.
Where you can see the reels of your work, Tim. I didn't discover that until recently, but you've got a whole best of reel.
There you go.
Very cool. And as always, you can find me at daisywhitney.com. You'll see links to the New Media Minute there and to many of my other ventures. I also am doing a couple tweaks to my website because I'm going to be blogging about writing, the writing process, the path to publication more regularly because many of you know that my novel is being published next fall by Little Brown, so I'm doing some more writing blogging. So definitely keep my site bookmarked, and we are over and out. Thank you.